Council, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Ann Parmley. Your Honors, I'm sorry. My registration number is 23223, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant mother, JVC, who is also present at council table. I apologize for the delay coming in. I didn't want to interrupt the previous proceedings, so we were staying outside. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to speak before this court, and I would like to believe that most of the facts of this case are not in dispute, but there are a few facts that I thought were significant that I want to further elaborate on beyond my brief. And those are significant because I believe they go to the factual finding of the court and the trial court regarding whether or not the mother complied with the treatment plan. The first being the UA tests. And I know in my brief I gave quite a bit of information about the UA tests that the mother went through over the course of the case. However, the testimony from the caseworker, Rachel Liebel, at the termination trial, in her testimony, she indicated that there were 7 positive UAs. And I believe that's contrary to the record and contrary to the stipulated exhibit that was even admitted at that trial. I believe out of those 7, there were 5 that were excused that were not accounted for at that trial and would have a significant impact on the outcome of the finding that whether or not the mother was in compliance with the UA testing.
Excuse me, Ms. Parmley, did trial counsel have the opportunity to cross-examine the social worker who testified about the UA test?
Yes.
And that's in the record, I assume?
Yes, it is. And as I know the court is aware, I was not the trial counsel, but in reviewing the record, I did locate a report that was part of the record and submitted by Social Services, the Department of Social Services, that showed that in December, the 3 UAs that were considered missed had been taken at alternate facilities, including 2 were taken at behavioral intervention, which is a approved facility that the treatment provider approved, and 1 was taken at Mount St. Vincent in Leadville, which was also is a hospital and was considered approved by the treatment provider.
Was that information brought out by trial counsel's cross-examination?
I don't believe so. There was also, I believe, in the stipulation itself, however, for February, one of the missed UAs stated that it was a false positive, and as I understood it from the record and from that stipulated exhibit, that it was ultimately determined to be negative. And there was also a UA taken in February that was positive, but only for the prescription, which was a valid prescription for Vicodin. There were 2 remaining UAs that were, 1 was missed, and that was in June of 2009. And that is a missed UA. However, there was a UA taken 2 days before and 2 days after, and that was a year into the treatment plan. The first UA that was considered positive was positive, and that was in early or late May 2008.
And Ms. Carly, let me back up a little bit. Is it your position that the treatment plan was appropriate?
Your Honor, it seems that I have 2 concerns about the appropriateness of the treatment plan. And that is, 1 is the visitation schedule. And whether or not the visitation that required the mother to travel a distance of generally at least 80 miles one way, whether or not that was reasonable. And the initial treatment plan, was entered in July of 2008. However, my client was then incarcerated and then went into inpatient. So when she returned, and the time frame I'm more speaking of is November 2008 through until June of 2009, that was a revised treatment plan was entered. And in that revised treatment plan, there was a plan for the child to be moved to Leadville to live in close proximity to the mother who was then living in Leadville. and to facilitate bonding and visitation. That was in the written treatment plan, and it was submitted to the court before the court on December 11th, 2009. That treatment plan, as far as the record indicates, was accepted. Now, there's no written order for that treatment plan that I've been able to locate, but there is a minute order in the Register of Actions, and it appears that the treatment plan that was submitted for that hearing was accepted. The child was never moved to the relative. The child was never moved any closer and remained with the current foster home. And that foster home was approximately, I believe, about 100 miles from my client's residence. So in, to that degree, that piece of the treatment plan never occurred. And had it occurred, that would have changed the whole visitation piece completely. And she could have had the opportunity for visits, you know, extenuated visits, and move in a much better pace towards reunification.
But as far as appropriateness, it's your position that the treatment plan was appropriate, it was just never properly implemented. It was later changed, wasn't it?
It was later changed to prohibit the department from facilitating any visitation.
And why is that?
It's my understanding on June 11th, 2009 hearing, after the guardian ad litem had filed a motion to decrease visitation, the court of its own accord determined to enter an order prohibiting the department from participating in any transportation services which had previously occurred.
And Ms. Parmley, as I understand, one of your arguments is that that part of the court's order was contrary to the statute.
Contrary to the statute, and also rendered the treatment plan further inappropriate. And there is one other piece that I have argued in my brief regarding the appropriateness of the treatment plan, and that is that the treatment plan, if it was a condition that, and as it appears from later expert, the expert interactional of Dr. Mangeau, that because the child was had a primary attachment to the foster parents, that it would be detrimental, potentially detrimental, to remove the child. That is the basis, basically, for the motion for termination of parental rights. It's my position that if the treatment plan required the mother to become equally a primary caretaker, or have the child be equally, at least equally attached, or replace the attachment with the mother, then a visitation schedule and the treatment plan, the way it was set up, could not be accomplished. It was doomed from the start, and failure was assured, because there would be no way that, I would say there'd be no way that a mother, no matter what her position is regarding fitness, per Dr. Mangeau's own report, through a series of 2 and 3 visits a week, could be expected to meet that same level of attachment that the child would have the primary caretaker that they live with every day and every night.
Then let me do have a follow-up question on this idea of appropriateness of the treatment plan. Does the court have to find by clear and convincing evidence that the treatment plan is appropriate in order to uphold the termination?
I believe so.
And that has to be done at clear and convincing evidence to satisfy due process?
Correct.
And does the court also have to find that the parent is unfit?
Correct.
And the conduct or condition of the parent is unlikely to change within a reasonable time.
That's my understanding.
And it's your position that based on the required findings, that the court cannot, the record cannot support those findings?
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And regarding the appropriateness of the treatment plan, I did want to cite to one case that's a little bit of an older case, but seemed to me that it was closer to the distinction that we have in this case, and that was in the interest of BJD, which is cited at 626 Pacific 2nd, 727, Colorado.
Is that in your petition?
It is in my petition.
Okay.
Just elaborating on that one, I think the facts are a little different here, because the fact of regarding the appropriateness of the treatment plan and requiring the parent to meet, I believe, a higher standard of fitness than is required by the statute is what occurred in this case. And that's why I am arguing that it wasn't appropriate if, in fact, it required this higher level of parenting than would be required by the statute, because by all accounts, the mother did comply with the treatment plan. She did do the substance abuse treatment. She did do the UA. She did have high recommendations from the providers that worked with her regarding her parenting and her bonding with the child. But nonetheless, because of the child had been living with the same foster parent, a motion for termination was requested.
Well, let me back up to the appropriateness question a little bit more. When the treatment plan was modified, and it sounds like it was modified twice, one to have the child move closer to mother, I assume trial counsel for mother did not object to that. Do you recall what happened at that hearing?
There's only a register of action. There's no, I could not find any written order, but it did not appear that there was an objection to that.
And then after, you said the treatment plan was modified once more. That required mother to travel to the child.
So mother was, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Mother was required to travel to the child throughout the whole treatment plan, but the department was providing some assistance as she had no means to transportation.
And the department stopped doing that sometime just prior to the termination, is that correct?
Per the court's order.
Did counsel for mother object to that?
I believe so, but I only understand from speaking with other counsel and from looking at the record. But I can't say for certain because it's not clear from the record.
Okay.
But I understanding from my from the mother as well as that was never something that was an option for her.
So as far as you know, there was a hearing on that modification, and counsel for mother said we object to that change in the treatment plan.
I believe that there was no request for it. I believe the court just ordered it. I don't believe any party requested it to be that way. As far as I understand, that wasn't what the motion was.
I thought you said on June 11th of 2009, the GAL filed some kind of motion to decrease the visitation.
In May of 2009, a motion to decrease visitation was requested, but it was not requested as part of that motion that the mother not have any assistance in attending those visits.
Did the counsel for mother object to that motion or anything along that line?
I believe in court, I believe there was a hearing on the issue and it even had some expert testimony.
And it's your impression that counsel did object at that point?
That's my impression.
Okay, thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
You have about 2 minutes and 35 seconds left. Are one of you GAL and one representing the county?
Your Honor.
Do you know how you're going to divide up the time?
Your Honor, Barry Meinster, 15483. I'm here for the GAL. Ms. Casillas is here for the county. We agreed that since our positions were similar, that I would take the vast majority of the argument. And if there was something that Ms. Casillas needed to add, she would add in, but we've discussed this.
Okay.
So basically, you're stuck with me.
Okay, that's fine. You may proceed.
Thank you. Your Honor, I'll try to be responsive to the arguments of counsel. First of all, the law is clear that if there is no objection to the treatment plan, then it can't be raised for the first time on appeal, and I believe it can't even be raised at the time of the conclusion of the termination proceeding. So I think the appropriateness of the treatment plan. And the law further goes on to say that if there are, unfortunately at this point in my life, I can't remember sites and things as well as I used to, but if the, it's the parent's responsibility to bring to the court's attention any perceived deficiencies in the treatment plan so that the court can adjust it. So I think that we need to start with the assumption or the conclusion that the treatment plan was appropriate.
Mr. Meinster, let me ask you about what Ms. Parmley was talking about regarding the trial court's decision not to provide for transportation assistance to the mother. Was that part of an amendment to the treatment plan?
Your Honor, again, I was not trial counsel, which is not an excuse, Your Honor. I've read through the record and in context, I believe what the court was trying to do at that point was have the mother demonstrate that she was committed to making the treatment plan work, making the relationship with the child work.
Well, I understand that from having read the petition and the opposition to the petition.
Right.
But what I'm asking you is specifically, was that part of the court's order considered as an amendment to the treatment plan?
Your Honor, I believe from what I understand that yes, it probably would have been an amendment to the treatment plan.
It sounds like you're speculating.
Well, I am. I didn't try the case, Your Honor, and the record doesn't really show exactly. I've been through what I refer to as the ICON records, which I believe is the registry of action, and I really couldn't get that straight in my head.
So, and then as a follow-up question, let me ask this. Ms. Parmley also suggested that she thought that the trial counsel for the mother also objected to this change with regard to the mother being required to pay for her own transportation. So since you weren't trial counsel, I gather that you are not aware as to whether or not there was any objection by the mother's trial counsel to that or part of the order by the trial court or not.
I am not aware of anything at the trial, but from the, again, what I refer to as the ICON records, there is a statement from counsel in one of the minute orders, and again, this is not a transcript, but there's a statement in one of the minute orders where trial counsel said that mother, and I'm paraphrasing, would go anywhere under any circumstances, something of that nature. And I believe I quoted that in my brief, where trial counsel did say that mother...
Right, I remember reading that in your brief, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the trial counsel would not have objected to a requirement that the mother travel 80 or 100 miles at her own expense in order to visit her child. Would you agree to that?
To an extent, Your Honor, I think that those records are relatively accurate, and I think if that representation was made by counsel, this was after the move, if I remember the dates correctly in my head. So if counsel was making that representation to the court, and the court, and that's what was recorded in the minute order, then I would conclude from that there was no objection to what the judge was ordering at that point in time.
What does the record show about the mother's employment or source of income?
Your Honor, the record shows that the mother was not employed. And that was one of the conditions of the treatment plan, that the mother obtain employment. Her income was from, and I forgot the acronym, but there's a state...
Was it TANF?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, that resource was available to her, and I believe the record also shows that there was a delay in her applying to that for 1 month. There's another interesting part about the income. Let me back up just 1 second about this move, Your Honor. Your Honor, this was the mother's choice. The mother was originally living closer to the children, and it was the mother who chose to move this great distance. It was not the county.
And why did she do that? Wasn't it to live with family members?
Your Honor, the sequence of this was that the mother originally, after this case was filed, fled to Texas. And
that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the move.
I understand that. And I think when she fled to Texas and came back and then went to jail, I think she put some of her other kids with other family members. This is my understanding, Your Honor. She put other kids with other family members, and then when she moved back to, or she got out of jail, at that point in time, she moved to where the other families were that were taking care of her kids, the family members that were taking care of her other children. So again, it was still her that made that move, as opposed to staying in Eagle County closer to AE, the child.
Did the judge address the fact why she didn't stay in Eagle County?
Not to my knowledge.
Well, that seems like a fact question, doesn't it? If she doesn't have sufficient income to live somewhere, she moves in with a family member with children on TANF, unlimited income, I think those are all questions of fact, aren't they?
They are questions of fact, Your Honor, and there's another fact that's very relevant to that, which is in the record, is that the mother was evicted from one, she lived in four different places, okay? This is besides her location in Texas and her time in a rehab center or whatever it was and in jail. But she was evicted because she couldn't pay her rent. And what the record shows is that she spent, at this time, she had $2,000 that she could afford to bail her ex-husband out of jail. So she checked.
That was early in the case?
I again, Your Honor, I'm not sure of the exact sequence of this, but it was about, I think the record shows it was about the same time.
That she returned?
I'm sorry?
That she returned from Texas?
Oh, after she returned from Texas, yes. And after she got out of jail, her husband, in fact, the marriage was after all this happened anyway.
But that all happened fairly early in this case, didn't it?
No, Your Honor, I believe that was after she returned from Texas and after, yes, I'm being confirmed on that, that was after she returned from Texas, after she got out of jail, that she had four different residences at that point in time. And I think what's significant for the court's question is that she had this $2,000 to bail her husband out, but she didn't have the money, or she chose. And I think this is what the trial judge was looking at when he made this decision that she needed to provide her own transportation. I don't think it was a punitive matter. I think it was designed to show, well, what is your commitment to this child here?
Mr. Meiser, I'm confused by your account of the events, because wouldn't it have been the case that if the mother had $2,000 that she available to bail her husband out, that she would not have been eligible for TANF?
I have no idea, Your Honor. I don't know what the requirements are for TANF. I don't know where the money came from. All I know is that the sequence shows that
Was she employed at any time during the course of this case?
No, sir.
Can I interrupt, please?
Sir.
Mr. Meister, I want to change the subject a little bit and ask a question, especially in light of you talking about the mother's other children. I want to ask a question about the finding of unfitness made by the court. I'm well aware that we have some case law that says a parent may be unfit as to one of her children without being unfit to all of her children.
Right.
But it's not clear to me from what we have before us now, what's in the record that supports a finding that mom can be a fit parent for five of her children, but she's not a fit parent for AE? If you could give me some information or something that's in the record, what is that finding based upon?
Well, Your Honor, the finding as to AE, okay, and that was the focus of the case. It's my understanding that there are other issues with the other children, but they were not brought in to this particular proceeding.
But they're living with her, correct?
They are living with her, Your Honor. But see, with AE, and this is why that case that Your Honor is referring to is significant, is that she was never, or AE was never with her.
Well, that's the distinction, isn't it? The distinction is that AE has spent all of
his life
with foster parents.
Right, that's correct.
And is that the reason that she's unfit?
In and of itself, no. Because she hasn't complied with the treatment plan, but the idea, yeah, well, all right, let me back up a second. Yes, I would say that all of the reasons that the trial court gave kind of are summed up by the fact with Dr. Mangio's testimony that you have a bond between AE and the foster parent. And as Dr. Mangio said, is it possible to transfer this bond? The answer to that question in the record is yes, it's possible. But under the circumstances of this case, the respondent mother is not fit because she can't provide the parenting within a reasonable period of time that would allow that bond to transfer without serious damage to AE, because the foster parents are the only parents that this child knows.
Well, if that's the case, yeah, then any parent whose newborn child goes immediately to foster care would have a very difficult, if not impossible, task of regaining custody of that newborn or that child. Would he or she not?
Under identical facts,
yeah,
yes. But if
but isn't that, Mr. Meiser, let yeah me just follow yeah up, because I think this really does go to the heart of this yeah case. 93604, and consistent with due process, mm-hmm, the court has to find by clear and convincing evidence that the parent is unfit.
Right.
And that conduct or condition is unlikely to change within a reasonable time, and that the treatment plan is appropriate to address all of that.
Right.
You would agree that that's required.
Yes.
And by clear and convincing evidence.
Right.
To satisfy due process.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm troubled by this. I mean, if the child is stable and doing really well in the foster home, I don't see how that relates to the separate finding of parental unfitness. I think that goes to the finding that the child's best interests, but that's different than terminating a parental right consistent with due process. I don't think the two are the same.
Parental unfitness is defined, in my understanding, within the context of the child. The focus is always on the child.
I agree.
All right.
But that's why the appropriateness of the plan seeking reunification, that's why that element, if you will, is also significant.
Right. If the mother had not left the state of Colorado, if the mother had not violated her probation, and I'll be honest with you, I'm not clear exactly what went on here, but apparently there was a violation of probation or something. She was incarcerated for a period of time. Then she could have done more to try to reunify herself with her child. The mother has to accept some responsibility for what has gone on here. And it was the mother who chose to flee the state of Colorado. It was the mother's action that wound her up. Can I finish the answer to the question?
Briefly,
sir?
Yes.
Yeah. It's the mother who took the actions that resulted in the child being in foster care for this extended period of time. And it's the mother who bears that responsibility. And as Dr. Mangio said, that yes, you could possibly transfer it, but this time it would be very detrimental. And then you have the statutes. You have the statutes which say, you know, the court looks at this in terms of being out of the care of the parent, you know, in foster care for 15 months. And then you have the other statute that says that a child shall be placed in a permanent home within 12 months. And it was the mother who didn't take the actions necessary for the reunification. And I think that's what the judge was basing his decision on, was that and shifting some of this responsibility to her. And she didn't comply with the rest of the plan.
All right, thank you. Ms. Parmley, Mr. Meinster ran over about a minute. You still have 2 minutes and 35 seconds, I believe.
With respect to the statements just made by Mr. Meinster that the mother needs to accept responsibility, I think that clearly she has taken that responsibility. This did happen in the beginning of the case. She did voluntarily return, contacted the caseworker before coming, talked to the caseworker about making arrangements for her children, and then turned herself in. She accepted responsibility. She was incarcerated, and she went into inpatient, which she certainly desperately needed at. And that opportunity really helped her. And when she returned from inpatient, the department sat down with her and created basically a revised and new treatment plan. The department at that point, the state, the court, and the department chose to implement a treatment plan to reunify her with her children. And to say now that those things were the reason she should have lost her parental rights would negate the whole purpose of entering a treatment plan in November of 2009 at all. In the November of 2008, when the court did implement a new treatment plan, by all accounts, from social service reports to the therapist reports, the mother did do what she needed to do to become fit, and did become fit. And the children of the five other children that she's caring for were part of the case. They were also added to the case, and she was considered fit to have those children. There's also, Mr. Meinster brought up that the mother had chosen to move from the area. The mother was living in Avon previously. When she came back from inpatient, she did live in Leadville, which is not a great distance, but it does add some miles. But even from Avon to where the child was placed in foster care, which was outside of Eagle County, was a distance, I believe, of at least 80 to 90 miles right there. The 80-mile drive was the drive for where the visitations were going to occur from Avon once the court decided to prohibit the transportation. There was still going to be an 80-mile distance just for visitations. So no matter where she was living, the distance was still a minimum of 80 miles between the homes.
At the permanency planning hearing, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, did the court enter concurrent plans of reunification and adoption?
Your Honor, I believe that at the December, from reading the register of actions, because there was no written order, it appears that at that hearing, the court entered a dual plan of allocation of parental rights as the concurrent plan, with reunification being the primary, or certainly listed first as the goal, and the goal of the treatment plan. And that time that was considered, I think, a 3-month treatment plan. And I did look back at that register of actions for the hearing in June of 2009.
When I see you're out of time, but I'll give you an extra minute since I gave Mr. Meinster about an extra minute to finish.
Thank you. In 2009, when the June of 2009, when the court determined to take away any visitation assistance, it's not clear, of course, whether or not there was an objection, because it appears this actually the part of the court's order that visitation assistance would be removed from the plan is not even in the register of actions. It says that the counsel made a statement. It says something about the therapist saying the mother would travel anywhere, but not the counsel. So not trial counsel for the mother. And if I have any seconds left, I just wanted to refer to the BJ, interest of BJD case, which also had a transportation issue in that case. And in that case, the court found that where there's, just because there is no objection, it does not necessarily mean that an inherently inappropriate treatment plan becomes appropriate, to the extent that if the court would find that. But also that in that case, there was a distance between the home, the mother and the child's foster home, of only 4 miles, but the mother had no access to transportation, and the court found that to be inherently inappropriate.
Okay, I see you're out of time. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes the oral arguments for this docket. The court will be in recess.